So for this evening's sutta reading, I chose a couple of short suttas from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's Anguttara Nikaya 2.23 and 25, and these both relate to the topic that I'd like to talk about this evening. Monks, these two slander the Tathagata. Which two? One who explains what was not said or spoken by the Tathagata as being said or spoken by the Tathagata, and one who explains what was said and or spoken by the Tathagata as not said or spoken by the Tathagata. There are two. These are two who slander the Tathagata. This is one short sutta, and the other short sutta, very similar. Monks, these two slander the Tathagata. Which two? One who explains a discourse, a sutta, whose meaning needs to be inferred as one whose meaning has already been fully drawn out. And one who explains a discourse whose meaning has already been fully drawn out as one whose meaning needs to be inferred. These are two who slander the Tathagata. The reason I wanted to introduce these two little sutta passages this evening was because I wanted to talk about the suttas and the Buddhist scriptures, and to give some a bit of an overview to what the Buddhist scriptures are and why they're relevant and how we can make use of them. And this is something that I speak about from time to time. Now, when we speak of the Buddhist scriptures, one of the issues which always comes up with the Buddhist scriptures, of course, is you have so many of them. You have these huge collections of texts, and it's can be quite intimidating. Yeah, how do you find what needs to be found? And not only is this such a huge collection, but there are many huge collections. So there's at least three large collections in Pali, Tibetan, and in Chinese. And of course, in the Buddhist world, almost everybody will simply, almost all the teachers in the Buddhist world will simply kind of refer to everything that's found in these collections as being spoken by the Buddha. Whereas, of course, historically, that's not the case. And so, if we don't have a grounding, if we don't have a perspective on what it is that the Buddha actually taught, and how that was developed, formed, and how that changed and was added to over the years, then it's very difficult for us to get, when we hear different teachers, yeah, and we hear, I was discussing this with Alex earlier, that we hear, you know, somebody from the Tibetan tradition speaks, somebody from the Chinese tradition speaks, someone from the Theravadan tradition speaks, and so on and so forth. And they're all saying things which in some ways are similar and in other ways are different. And it's very difficult to actually work out how these things relate to each other. So we can end up in a quite chaotic situation where you're just sort of, you know, trying to make sense of it all. So on the one hand, in terms of spiritual practice, then you know, ultimately, of course, you know, we would like to think that we can make sense of that through the depth and penetration of our own spiritual wisdom, right? Good luck, yeah? What can I say, yeah? It's not so easy, is it, yeah? And when you hear these different teachings, yes, I mean, if you do have a lot of spiritual wisdom and you can understand it in that way, terrific, yeah? And if it's not causing a problem for you, fantastic. And if you can listen to the wisdom coming from different places and draw from those different messages which are enriching your own spiritual practice, then terrific, that's not a problem, yeah? And then you can proceed in that way. But for a lot of people, that's not how it is. For a lot of people, it tends to be more confusing rather than anything else. We're not sort of sure how these things relate to each other. Throughout history and throughout all of the different Buddhist traditions, there's been many attempts made in different ways to do this, to organize all of the Buddha's teachings to systematize things and to say this is how this relates to that and this relates to that in this way. And that's been done many different times in different places, especially in the Tibetan, Chinese and Japanese traditions. There's a strong tendency to do this. And of course, when you look at that, of course, what you find is that in each case, the person who's done that has their own perspective on Dhamma, and they'll always say, well, this is the highest teaching, and then all of these are lesser teachings, or all of these are ways of approaching those highest teachings, and so depending on what your own version of the highest teaching is. And most of those major systems are quite anti-historical. Okay, so that is, they're not derived from a realistic sense of how Buddhist scriptures developed, how they evolved, how the Buddhist teaching developed over time in different places. That's not to say they're completely ahistorical, because the actual historical structure of Buddhism is actually inherent even in those much more developed teachings. So, for example, if you study most forms of Tibetan Buddhism, they will tell you that, you know, you have to first of all study the teachings of what they call the Hinayana. If they're being a bit rude, Hinayana means crappy vehicle, all right? So you translate Hina, they often translate a small vehicle. It's not actually correct. Hina never means small. Hina means lesser or inferior. It's literally is formed grammatically, it's a past participle of the word to throw something out. Okay, so it means what's been chucked out. Okay, in other words, the rubbish vehicle. Right? So, and it was always meant in a pejorative sense. The more polite term is Shravakayana, which means the disciple's vehicle. And if you hear, for example, someone like the Dalai Lama, he will never use the word Hinayana, he'll always use the word Shravakayana, the disciple's vehicle. And what that means is that it's the way of practice and the teaching for those who are aiming for arahantship, for enlightenment as a disciple of the Buddha, rather than for enlightenment as a Buddha themselves. Yeah? And so that's quite a perfectly usable term. So even within, say, the Tibetan tradition, they will say, you know, you have to first of all study and practice the Shravakayana tradition, and then when that's done, then you study and practice the Mahayana tradition, and when you've mastered that, then you can master the specific sort of tantric practices which are particular to the Vajrayana tradition. And actually that sequence of teachings is in fact how those different teachings evolved in ancient India. Yeah? The early Buddhism is found within what they call the Shravakayana. A somewhat later development is found within the Mahayana. And the latest development of all is found within the Vajrayana. So even though these ways of systematizing things are not sort of explicitly, or they don't acknowledge their own historical roots, but there is still something of a historical sequence involved there. So what I'd like to talk about just a little bit this evening is to try to put that history on a bit more of a grounded basis, so that we know actually what it is that we're talking about when we're talking about Buddhist scriptures. Okay, so we'll start with the beginning, all right? What's the beginning? The beginning was a failure. Something that's not often acknowledged within the Buddhist tradition, but the Buddha's first teaching was when he met the wanderer Upaka on the road from Bodh Gaya to Benares, and he tried to teach him but couldn't convince him, and he wandered off down another road and disappeared from history. Okay? And his name is Upaka, which means nearly there. Yeah? But not quite. Actually, there are some Buddhist legends about what happened to him, but in the early tradition he just vanished. So that, to me, that's one of the most inspiring and reassuring aspects of the whole of the Buddhist canon. Ah, even the Buddha failed sometimes. Ah, thank goodness. He can't always convert everybody or reach everybody if they're not ready. So that's a bit, I find that very reassuring. Then, of course, he went on to Benares and taught what is usually known as the first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. and it's a very long name, but it means the rolling forth of the wheel of the Dhamma, yeah, a very famous discourse. And that particular sutta, the Buddha teaches the two extremes of self-mortification and self-indulgence. He teaches the middle way as the Eightfold Path, as the escape from those two extremes, and he teaches the Four Noble Truths as the pattern or the structure of insight which that middle way will lead to, and he teaches the attainment of liberation and freedom from rebirth, which is the goal of that practice. So that's the primary sutta, the primary teaching of the Buddha, and I think it's difficult to overestimate the importance of that one fairly short and fairly simple teaching within the structure of the Buddha's dispensation as a whole. Elsewhere, the Buddha said that everything that he taught was part of the Four Noble Truths. He said that just as the elephant's footprint is the greatest footprint of any animal, and all other footprints will fit within that footprint. This is in the Mahāhatipadopama Sutta in the Majjhima Nikāya. Yeah, so too, all of the other teachings that he taught fit within the Four Noble Truths. So in that first discourse, he's establishing an overall pattern, an overall framework within, and everything that follows afterwards relates to that in some way. Yeah? Everything relates, it fits in with those Four Noble Truths in some way. The more you go into these things, the more you realize how powerful it is, because that teaching on the Four Noble Truths, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, on the one hand was extremely personal and specific and directed from his experience of his two extremes of self-indulgence and self-mortification, and directly to the experience of the people who he was talking to. Yeah. So on the one hand, it was very specific and contextual, but on the other hand, it established that whole framework which guided all of the rest of the teachings for the remaining 45 years of his life. Yeah. So the more you go into these very simple teachings, what appear on the surface to be very simple teachings, the more you realize how much depth there is to them. So from then on, the Buddha taught. So if you want to try to understand these scriptures, you have to sort of cast our mind back into that world. Yeah? Yeah? So we think, you know, there's jungles everywhere. Elephants, tigers, ghosts, yuccas. The world is an untamed place. People know about, you know, a few kingdoms around them in the Ganges Valley, but they don't know much outside of that. There's a complex and changing religious and spiritual culture which already has a lot of depth through the Vedic tradition, which goes back already thousands of years before the time of the Buddha, as well as the diverse local cults and practices and worship that's going on, as well as quite a few other revolutionaries, the other Shramana tradition, yeah, the Jaina tradition, Purana, Makkali Gosala, and other, who are all teaching these quite radical and revolutionary doctrines. So the period of ferment and change. Society had been in change. There had been fairly recently before that the widespread introduction of iron, and consequently much bloodier warfare. There was a consolidation of the traditional smaller clan-based nation-states, which were starting to be consolidated into more militarized and organized kingdoms. But still, you know, there would be long walking. When the Buddha was teaching, there would be long periods of walking through the jungle with little around, you know, maybe an isolated household or a bit of farming going on here and there, a small little village, and then a few somewhat large cities. I mean, quite small cities by our present day standards, but you know, in those days, a place like Sarvatthi or Rajagaha was, you know, the height of the a metropolis. I mean, 150 years later, in the time of King Ashoka, there was the city of Pataliputta, which was indeed a huge city by any standards. Yeah, that was the Rome of the ancient world, and that was a vast metropolis, probably a million people or something like that there. But in the time of the Buddha, the cities hadn't reached that kind of scale. So this was the context that the Buddha was teaching in. Now, as he would go from place to place, he would meet different people, different individuals. Now remember, he wasn't teaching in a university. There wasn't like a curriculum, right? He didn't have to, didn't have to meet certain kind of standards on what he was teaching and these kinds of things. He just had to, who are these people in front of me? How can I connect with those people, you know, through using the Dhamma? And he did that too on an individual basis, on a collective basis. He did that through meeting, people who were advanced philosophers, ascetics, yogis and advanced meditators, people in positions of power in society, kings and generals and great merchants. He did it by talking to farmers, Brahmins, religious specialists who were coming to argue with him and refute him. He did it with people who were from the poorest part of society, the outcasts. He spoke with monastics and with lay people, with men and with women. There's the conversion of corrupt tax collectors, the murderer Angulimala, a number of prostitutes, all people from all different strata and kinds of society that the Buddha was meeting, interacting with and teaching with. You know, little children, there's discourses when the Buddha's walking for alms round and he comes across a bunch of kids who were playing with a crab in a pond and tearing its legs off for fun, yeah? And so, you know, the Buddha says, you know, do you think that creature feels pain? They said, well, yeah. Do you like it when you feel pain? They said, well, no, not really. Well, how do you think that crab likes it when you cause that pain? Well, probably doesn't like it very much. So do you think that's the right thing to do? And they say, well, no, probably not really, yeah? And so even with little kids, he'll teach them and engage with them, not trying to, you know, and even at that level, he's not saying, don't do that, it's wrong, but he'll reach out to them, engage with them, and draw out their own knowledge, yeah? So we find this incredible skillfulness in the Buddha's teaching, the way he presented to so many different kinds of people and engaging in so many different kinds of contexts. And this is one of the great, always regarded within the traditions as one of the great skills of the Buddha, that he knew how to relate appropriately in all of these different contexts. So there's an astonishing richness and variety within the Buddha's scriptures. Now, what there wasn't at that time was paper, right? Nor were there iPads. All the religious scriptures up to that point in India had been passed down purely by the oral tradition, right? And paper was only introduced much later, and actually it was introduced by the Buddhists. Okay, so the Buddhist Sangha was, as far as we know, the first movement to use physical manuscripts, which were made of birch bark in the north and palm leaf in the south, for writing religious texts. At that time, in the time of the Buddha, there was writing. It seems that there probably was writing, but it was used in a much more limited way, perhaps mostly for perhaps royal decrees and governmental purposes, also for trade. Making inventory. We're sending off 17 camels and 14 goats, and they'd better arrive at the other end. Personal letters and some things like that. So, but it wasn't used for religious scriptures. It was probably they didn't have the technology to create large amounts of long manuscripts that would be actually suitable for longer things. So it was actually only used for small bits. So the actual word for a page in Pali just means a leaf. Yeah. So they probably just used various dried leaves and things like that. So the scriptures were preserved through the oral tradition. That means that they were memorized and recited. And we find that many of the suttas actually talk about this process, how to do it. And when we come to that from a modern perspective, we find it very difficult to remember what our shopping list is, right? Yeah, there's five things I needed to get at the deli. There's milk, bread, right? And actually, you know, that's part of our education, is that we're very good at like paying attention, and we've got a very kind of flexible way of doing things, coping with different situations and assessing different kinds of information and so on. But so that's kinds of skills we've learnt very well, but we haven't learnt that skill of memory very well. And so we tend to find it difficult to understand how so much can be memorized. But it can. We know that it can, and all of the studies of oral literature have shown how it's possible to preserve texts, not just in a general sense, okay, but in terms of specific details. And here we compare this kind of religious literature with, say, folk literature, where you have, like, with fairy stories and folk tales is also passed down through an oral tradition. But those fairy stories and folk tales are passed down in a fairly loose manner. They're always embellished by the storyteller, who will keep the main features of the story intact but will vary it around. And, of course, you find that within Buddhism as well, like, for example, with the Jataka stories and so on, that they also may be told in a somewhat loose way. But with the actual canonical text, what we find is a much more specific and much more, if you like, technical approach to memorizing the exact text, the exact words. And we find that very often those exact words are preserved unchanged throughout. They can be preserved unchanged throughout even thousands of years in the oral tradition. And there are specific techniques which the reciters use to maintain those texts without changing them. So, again, to cast yourself back into that world, the Buddha's going around teaching from place to place. Clearly, he was a very powerful and charismatic teacher, right? Clearly, he had a tremendous effect on so many people who came to see him and listen. And they devoted, you know, their lives to him. They committed their full attention and their full effort to learning what he had to say. And clearly, there wasn't just one or two. There was lots. There was at least hundreds, probably thousands. And they were applying their mind to memorizing and passing these scriptures down the best that they could. And remember also that the Buddha, because of his great skill in rhetoric and language, was quite consciously constructing his teachings in a way so that they could be memorized. Yeah. Now, I have the luxury of not having to do that, right? Because there's a camera over there, and it's recording things. If you guys forget something, well, you can go and look it up on the web later on. It's all right. Yeah. So we have a different way of communicating now. But in the Buddha's time, he knew that he had to communicate in such a way that it was comprehensible, that it was memorizable. And so we find in the Buddhist scriptures a lot of use of techniques that help to ensure the accurate memorization of the scriptures. The most obvious of those techniques is repetition. Constantly we're finding repetition on all kinds of level, on individual words repeated, phrases are repeated, sentences are repeated, paragraphs are repeated, whole texts are repeated. Yeah, constantly we find this. And this is all backup of data, right? That's all it is. It's backing up your data. And anybody who does any kind of work with information knows that information that isn't, if your data isn't backed up, it doesn't exist. Yeah? So this is the same way with the Buddhist scriptures. Everything is redundant. So you can lose a sentence, you can lose a word, you can lose a whole sutta. It doesn't really matter, because in the scheme of things, it's always somewhere else. Yeah, there are always multiple copies of it and multiple redundancies. So, and this, of course, aids in that whole memorization process. So Buddha taught, all these things were gradually memorized. After the Buddha passed away, they came together at what's called the First Council to recite these scriptures. Now, all of the traditions agree on that, but they disagree about the details of actually what was recited at that first council. Okay? And essentially, if you look in each tradition, what they say is that what was recited at the first council was our scriptures. Yeah? And then the next mob will say, no, it was our scriptures that were cited. And the next mob will say, it was our scriptures that were cited, and so on. So the details of that differ, but the general principle remains. Now, so what I want to just mention now here briefly is probably what was recited at that point and what actually we have in terms of the Buddhist scriptures today. So essentially what was recited at the First Council and what was the words of the Buddha, more or less, is what we call the suttas and the Vinaya. Okay. The suttas are the Buddha's discourses, the general teachings of the Buddha. So when I read those couple of little passages at the beginning, then that's two small suttas. And suttas might be just a short passage like that. They might be a whole verse. They might be a very long, might take several hours. Yeah? So different lengths. And very diverse in terms of their topics, in terms of their literary structure, and so on. The Vinaya is the monastic discipline for the monks and nuns. And so the Vinaya is much more, in a sense, it's a much more focused type of literature. It's much more structured and specific. It has a much more limited purpose, and that is to provide a management and disciplinary framework for the monastic communities. So that, I mean, the Vinaya has actually, of course, tremendous amounts that's useful and beneficial in it, but the main thing that's useful for most people is the suttas. Now, when we look at what these things are that we call the suttas were collected and they exist today in what we call four or five nikayas, is the word we use mostly in the Pali tradition, and the word that's used in the northern traditions usually is agamas. Actually, the word agamas is a better word to use, but nikayas is more well known in the Theravada tradition. And those four agamas or nikayas are the Digha Agama, Digha Agama in Sanskrit, or the Digha Nikaya in Pali, the Madhyama Agama in Sanskrit, or the Madhyama Nikaya in Pali, the Sanyukta Nikaya in Pali, or the Sanyukta Agama in Sanskrit, and the Anguttara Nikaya in Pali, or the Ekottara Agama, Anguttara Nikaya or Ekottara Agama in Sanskrit. And these are the four main collections, and in addition to that collection, there's a fifth minor collection called the Kuddaka Nikaya. Kuddaka Nikaya as such only exists in the Pali, although there probably were other Kuddaka Nikayas around the place. Now, these four, so we'll leave the fifth Nikaya out of it just for the sake of simplicity. So if we look at these four Nikayas and four Agamas, all the information that we have suggests that all of the ancient Buddhist schools had these four collections. Okay, let's call them Agamas for now. Okay, so all of the schools of ancient Buddhism had a collection of four Agamas. According to traditional accounts, there were 18 such early schools. Okay, one of which was the what we call today the Theravada, which was established at the Mahavihara in Sri Lanka. But there were 18 other schools. Actually, there was probably both more and less than 18. There was more schools if you count all of the detailed little sub-schools and sects and so on, but much less if you count the ones where there was a really genuine difference between the schools. If you look at the genuinely different schools, there's probably about four or five. And all of them had these four agamas, okay? Dirga agama, Majjhima agama, Sanyukta agama, and Ekottara agama. Dirga agama is long discourses, Majjhima agama, middle-length discourses, Sanyukta agama is discourses collected according to topic, and so in there you find them according to the most central topics in Buddhism. Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Dependent Origination, Five Aggregates, Six Senses, the elements, and so on. So all of those really central teachings in Buddhism have their main collection of suttas in the Sanyutta Agama. And then finally is Ekottara Agama, or Anguttara Nikaya, and that is discourses collected numerically. Okay, so there is this one thing in those discourses I read earlier were from the Anguttara Nikaya, and that was there were these two things, yeah? So these two people who slander the Buddha. And then the three things and the four things up to 11. Okay, so for some reason, which I've never seen a particularly good explanation for it, but the different versions of the Ekotra Agama that we have all seem to go up to 11. Whether there's any connection with Spinal Tap, I have no idea. But anyway, so, and the Anguttara Nikaya tends to be more, tends to deal with more, see, most of the central doctrines are discussed in the Samyutta Nikaya and Majjhima Nikaya, so the Anguttara tends to be more miscellaneous. So, for example, like those little ones that I read there, they're talking about ways of interpreting and understanding the scriptures. So it's a little bit more miscellaneous rather than kind of focusing so much on the central main doctrines, which are mainly treated in some of the other Nikayas. So these four. Each of the schools of early Buddhism had these four agamas, although in each case they're slightly different. Okay? They're pretty much the same, but there's always some slight differences. Now, when we're at Santi Monastery, we teach these things regularly, and we go through the suttas and we study these things, and we always study them on a comparative basis. So you don't look at just the Pali version, but we look at all the versions of these suttas that are in existence. Okay? Now, the ones that are in existence, even though 18 schools all had their version of them, now, it would be great to have all of those. Imagine how much work there'd be if we had 18 versions of the Pali Canon. Well, my goodness, yeah? But fortunately or unfortunately, there's not 18 versions in existence today. There's one complete version of the early scriptures, and that's in the Pali Canon, which is the version which has been passed down and preserved in the Theravadan tradition in Sri Lanka. There's also a set of four agamas found in the Chinese Tripitaka, yeah? And these are translations of the Agama scriptures from the early Buddhist schools. And they're pretty much similar to what we find in the Pali Nikayas. Actually, in the Chinese, they have, as well as the four Agamas, they also have quite a large variety of miscellaneous Agama-style texts. So either individual suttas that were translated another time, or partial collections, or collections which are related to the Agama collections and so on. So the Chinese canon actually has quite a lot more early Buddhist material than the Pali does, yeah? A greater quantity. Yeah, but, of course, because it's in a Chinese translation, it's not so easy to understand it specifically, because obviously there's some fuzziness and ambiguity in the translation. So the Pali is the most valuable source for early Buddhism, because we can access the original text very easily. So these four agamas in Chinese are extremely important for understanding early Buddhism. They're absolutely crucial, and yet hardly studied at all. There's only been, I know of, four books ever in the history of Buddhism that have been published that study these four texts in detail, these groups in detail. That's a bit sad, really. Oh, five books, I have to say. I forgot mine. All right, okay. I did one. And there's been a few other things, but really hardly studied at all. So in addition to those, there's also in the Tibetan canon, there are also some of the early Agama scriptures, although in the Tibetan canon they don't have any full Agama collections. Okay, they have some individual Agama sutras, maybe about 20 or 30 sutras altogether. Things like the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta they have, the Sunyata Sutras in the Majjhima Nikaya, and a few other things, but not a huge amount. And there's also some early Agama material which is quoted in later scriptures. Yeah. When we're talking about what the Buddha taught, that's what he taught. Okay, that body of material that I've just described, that's it. Now, remember in that sutta that I read at the beginning, it said it's a slander for the Buddha to say that this is something that he taught when he didn't in fact teach it. Yeah? Or to say the other way around. Yeah? So we have to, this is something which is clearly was a concern for the Buddha and for the tradition from the earliest time. The reason I make this point is because sometimes people especially from more of a postmodern perspective, like to say that this kind of concern for the authenticity of the early scriptures is a kind of modernist Western imposition, and that's kind of Protestant Buddhism and all of these kinds of things. And that ignores the fact that it actually is clearly a concern articulated within the early texts themselves, and which you can find repeatedly discussed within the traditions. You know, what really is the things that the Buddha himself taught? Now, I think we can say with a pretty high degree of certainty that everything, all of the authentic Buddha's words and teachings that we have are within that literature. That is to say, I don't think there's anything outside of that literature that can, in any meaningful or plausible way, be traced to the historical Buddha himself. Okay? However, of course, there is much within that literature which is not the words of the Buddha. Right? It's not to say that everything in the four Nikayas or four Agamas is the words of the Buddha. Clearly, that isn't the case. Some of those things are, and I think, in fact, most of those things which are the important teachings can be attributed to the Buddha himself. Now, this is a question which there's, obviously I don't have time to discuss in detail, but when we're considering what it is that the Buddha taught and what he didn't teach, this is a complex question which we use the methods of what's called text-critical analysis to try to discern. Now, the methods of text-critical analysis are always uncertain, right? But they can give us answers with a certain degree of probability. And one of the most overwhelmingly strong impressions, or strong not impressions, but strong conclusions, which text-critical analysis brings us is this. And this is something, again, that we do every week at Plenty Monastery, and we observe this consistently, not just once or twice, but over hundreds and hundreds of texts when we observe them. If you look at the structure of most texts, and if you say that sutta that I read out at the beginning, that was just a direct address by the Buddha. It's very short and simple. It didn't have any fancy stuff there, just a very short direct statement. Now, that's quite unusual, because it's such a short sutta. Most suttas have a more complex literary form. Usually that literary form is like this. At the beginning there's an introduction. Yeah? The asava I heard at one time, the Blessed One was saying at Savatthi in Jetagro and Atapindika's park. There may be more or less detail. It might be just very simple, or it might go on some detail and giving a narrative background as to where the teaching came from. Then the Buddha starts to speak, and he gives a number of teachings, yeah? And then finally there's a conclusion, yeah? And sometimes, again, very simple, that people rejoiced in the Buddha's words and so on. The important thing to notice about that structure is it's only those middle bits which the text actually attributes to the Buddha. Yeah? The text isn't saying, the Buddha never said, thus have I heard, at one time the Blessed One was saying in Savatthi, right? He never said those things, right? But somehow in our consciousness, when we think about it, we assume that somehow the Buddha said everything that's in the suttas, and we assume that he said that, no, he didn't say those bits, actually. Those bits were added by the redactors at a later time. What he said were those, he said that the meat in the sandwich, right? The tofu in the sandwich. He said that those actual teachings. And when you study these things on a comparative basis, yeah, looking at the Pali, the Chinese, the Tibetan, the Sanskrit, all of these different versions of these texts, usually in most significant texts you've got at least two versions of every sutta, often three or four. And when you study these, you find almost all the time that this part in the middle is basically identical across every version. Okay, sometimes there's some small variations, but almost all the time it's almost identical. Whereas these beginning and ending bits can be quite different. Okay, so there's a lot more variation. So for example, one sutta might say it's set at Savatthi, another one says it's set at Rajagaha. Okay, one sutta says at the end of the sutta, the person the Buddha was talking to took refuge and expressed his joy, whereas another one might say he became enlightened and became a monk, or something like that. So those narrative details will differ quite a bit from sutta to sutta, but the actual teachings themselves almost always are very, very consistent. So what's the most plausible explanation for that state of affairs? Well, the most plausible explanation is that in the time of the Buddha, the Sangha was very determined to remember and preserve those things that the Buddha actually said as best as they possibly could. And they remembered that and passed that down. As time went on, they gradually would have started to develop the narrative setting that would give the context for that text. So you don't need the narrative setting to begin with, right? Yeah, you don't. I'm sitting here talking to you guys now, right? All that you're paying attention to is what I'm saying, right? Later on, maybe you'll go away and talk to somebody else, and you'll say, thus have I heard, at one time in the Well Awareness Centre in North Sydney, Bhante Sujato was addressing a group of people, and he spoke thus. Right? So you put that on when it's being retold later, then those narrative things are developed to give a framework for it, yeah? So, and I think this is why there's that variation, because the actual words of the Buddha were preserved very carefully and very precisely, and the narrative context was sort of developed in a somewhat loose and flexible way. So even though, you know, we can't agree with the more fundamentalist claim that everything in those four Nikayas or four Agamas was literally spoken by the Buddha, I think that there are very good reasons to think that the teachings, the doctrinal teachings that are taught there are, for the most part, an accurate and reliable preservation of what the Buddha taught. I don't see any reason to doubt that. I've gone on far too long talking about this, I'm running out of time, but just to very briefly sum up what happened after that, then one of the problems was that the suttas are specific and contextual. Right? It's this advice to that person. It's that meditation advice to that person in that context. And so it's all different things taught in different times in different places. And so what was felt was needed afterwards was a general overview of the Buddha's teachings. Yeah? And so that general overview of the Buddha's teachings was the beginnings of what we call the Abhidhamma. Yeah? And so the Abhidhamma takes those teachings from the suttas, it arranges them in a formal manner, systematizes them, defines all the terms. It's partly like a dictionary. It's partly like an encyclopedia. It's sort of where you move to that more systematic way of doing things rather than that personal teaching, which is what we find in the suttas themselves. And of course, when you do that, it changes things. No matter how much you want to try to keep things the same, there's a difference between a living teaching that a spiritual teacher gives to a person in a time and a place, yeah, and a summary and definition of what that teacher has given over their lifetime. Inevitably, because of the form of it, you know, it's changed, right? So then how you do that was then handled in different ways. So just as all of the early schools, 18 early schools, had the four agamas, similarly all of the early schools had an Abhidhamma. But whereas the agamas were, say, 80% shared between the schools with maybe 20% variation, the Abhidhamma was maybe 20% shared and 80% variation. Yeah? In other words, the Abhidhammas were developed individually by the schools. And, you know, you can imagine what's happening, that the teachers are setting up now in different monasteries, you know, some in Sri Lanka, some in Kashmir, some in Pataliputta, some in Avanti, and they're developing a curriculum, a way of teaching within their context, which is suited to their particular approach to Dhamma, emphasizes the things that they think are important, and so on and so forth. And so this is where the Abhidhamma literature evolves from. As that Abhidhamma literature evolved, it moved on from being just like a compendium and assembling of doctrines to being more analytical and reflective and philosophical. Right? Gradually it became more abstract, so it's more like a philosophical analysis of the Dhamma rather than just an arrangement of the Dhamma. And from that period we then have the arising of what we call the Mahayana. So when we talk about the Mahayana, we're talking minimum of about 400 years after the Buddha, although in fact Mahayana was never prominent in India until maybe 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. Okay? Mahayana existed, the scriptures were existed, many of them were even taken to China and translated, but within India it was very much a minority movement for at least the first 1,000 years or so. Okay? Now, with the Mahayana literature, we see the emergence of a whole new class of suttas. And those suttas present themselves as being teachings of the Buddha. They start out, thus have I heard, at one time the Blessed One was staying at Rajagaha, and so on. But whereas the early suttas are fairly plain and straightforward and prosaic, yeah, the Buddha was staying in Rajagaha, and there he addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus, and goes on to teach. The Mahayana suttas are extremely elaborate, yeah. Yes, and the Buddha was staying on Vulture's Peak, and at that time thousands of bodhisattvas came and tens of thousands of devas and countless beings and so on and so forth. And it goes on, it's very florid, and it's a whole Bollywood thing. Right? And we've seen the emergence of that whole kind of creativity and that imagination. There's a whole upsurge of inspiration. It's an inspired literature, yeah, which has both very incisive and profound philosophical developments. Yeah, things like the Prajnaparamita suttas and so on are very subtle philosophical texts. And actually, there's a monk who's a friend of mine has just written his PhD thesis on the Prajnaparamita, and he's revealed quite a fantastic thesis. He's revealed this kind of hidden structure which is guiding the whole formation of these vast Prajnaparamita literature, which previous generations of scholars had just not discerned at all because it's so big and so complex. So these are extremely sophisticated texts, yeah, which on the one hand have that astonishing kind of intellectual aspect, but also this amazing creativity and so on. One of the things that lay behind that literature, I believe, was the development of writing and the use of literature, and I believe that this was the first strata of Buddhist literature which was originated as a literary form, yeah, written down. And I think that the possibilities of writing led to that upsurge of creativity. Why do the Mahayana Sutras say that they are literally the words of the Buddha when they quite obviously are not? Well, you can. There's many reasons that you can discuss for that. Just very, very briefly, I'd say that in many cases, I think that the authors of those texts would have been inspired by the Buddha, would have felt that they were inspired by the Buddha, perhaps through visions that they received in meditation, and that they wrote down, and that the form of those suttas. And this is something which is often not appreciated. The form of those suttas, it seems to me, is created in a way that the authors deliberately expected their audience to know that these weren't really authentic suttas. Okay? It's easy to fake a sutta. Right? They're so stereotyped. If I want to invent a fake Pali sutta, today, it's very easy, yeah? Eva me sutang ekang samayang bhagava savatiyang viharati deyatavaneyanastapindakas arame. And then you can put it in there and, you know, cut and paste some standard passages from elsewhere in the suttas, change a few words around to make your special point, and there you go, right? It's actually very easy, yeah? And these people who composed the Mahayana literature were extremely sophisticated. If they wanted to do something that simple, they easily could have, but they didn't. They chose to develop an entirely new kind of literature, which would have struck the people at that time, who were used to that early Buddhist form, would have struck them as this radical innovation, this radically new thing. And so I don't think that it could have been intended to have been passed off as realistically historical literature, any more than someone today would see Harry Potter as being a documentary about public school life in England. Okay? Now, you can imagine that, say, in 2,000 years' time, somebody might think that, right? Someone might think, wow, you know, in those days they had this amazing technology and these books that would do these kinds of things, and how did they get that, you know? Because we don't know the context. But in that time and that place, I don't think it's possible that anybody would have actually thought that. But of course, as time went on, and the origins of those texts began to be obscured, then gradually they came to be thought of in that way. This is how I understand it. So once the Mahayana Sutras appeared, then they then went through their own evolutionary process. It's a very complex situation, but also on top of that, then they developed philosophical treaties based on that Mahayana literature. We're now coming to about the 3rd or 4th century in AD, and in that period was composed the great treaties, which from that time until the present day constitute the actual main doctrinal basis of Buddhist teaching. In the Pali or Theravadan tradition, that's the book we call the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, and the various commentaries which were compiled and edited, notice not composed, but compiled and edited by Buddhaghosa in the Mahavihara in Sri Lanka, based on the Pali canon. And effectively from that time until the present day, Buddhaghosa's interpretation of the Dhamma has remained the standard orthodoxy within the Theravadan school. That defines the Theravadan school. In the northern tradition, a similar thing happened a little bit earlier with the writings of Nagarjuna. Probably the two most important ones would be Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu. There's quite a few others, but these seem to be the most influential. Nagarjuna, of course, most famous for developing his philosophy of emptiness. And Vasubandhu, probably his most influential work, was a work called the Abhidharma Kosha, which is the standard Abhidharma work, which is still relied on, especially within the Tibetan tradition and also within the Chinese tradition as well. So this is one thing which is important to know. In the Tibetan canon, okay, Tibetan is huge, but there are no Agama collections, and there's just a few early Buddhist suttas. All right. When the Tibetans refer to and talk about, because the Tibetans still study what they call Shravakayana, they study early Buddhism, but what they're referring to is the Abhidharma Kosha. Okay, that's what they study. In fact, they probably don't study that, they actually study commentaries on that, right? But that's the basic text that they call early Buddhism. And that's a text by Vasubandhu, written in about 3rd or 4th century, which summarizes the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma prevalent in that time. So it's just important to understand that context. It's not necessarily exactly the same as what's found in the early suttas. Of course, much of it is, right? Most of the things found in the Abhidharma Kosha are very recognizable to someone who's a student of early Buddhism. But of course, it always has its own developments and so on. So it's just that if we know that, we can understand, if I'm hearing a Tibetan teacher and they refer to early Buddhism, that's what they're referring to. Yeah? And if that differs in some way what you've read from the Pali Canon, then you understand why that is. Yeah? So, as well as the Abhidharma Kosha, and of course, one I omitted, I should have mentioned, was Asanga. And Vasubandhu's brother, Asanga, composed a massive treatise, again around the 400 time, called the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra. And that plays an influential role within the Mahayana traditions, which is similar to or comparable to that of the Visuddhimagga within the Theravadan tradition. So the main doctrinal teachings of Mahayana have been based on that Yogacara Bhumi Shastra since that time. And again, just very, very briefly, after that period, which if you like is the classical period of Buddhist literature, the only major or the only popularly influential development subsequent to that was the development of what they call Vajrayana or sometimes Tantrayana. And what Vajrayana or Tantrayana is a further development of Mahayana, so it's a kind of Mahayana. There's no particular philosophical development, okay? So it's the same teaching as the teaching in Mahayana, but what Tantrayana is the development of certain specific kinds of ritual, contemplation, symbolism, and praxis, which are meant to provide a practical way of implementing those teachings found in the Mahayana sutras, okay? So it's a new way of realizing and putting into practice the Mahayana sutras, and this is what's called Tantrayana. And Tantrayana itself is very complex, but it uses Tantrayana is, of course, mostly what's practiced in Tibetan Buddhism today, although there are Tantrayana schools in China and Japan especially, but they sort of tend to be a minority there. So they have certain practices which are developed, but the philosophy is still the philosophy of Mahayana. So Tantrayana is really just a part of Mahayana. So I'm going way over my time, so I could keep on talking about these things all night. But anyway, that's giving you a bit of an overview of the Buddhist literature and how they fit together in a historical context. And just let me just say as one final point to say here is that it is trendy in academic circles, and it's filtered down into other areas of Buddhist discourse to diss this kind of analysis for various reasons, and to sort of cast doubt on you know how true it is, or how much we can know what was early and what was late, and all of these kinds of things. That those criticisms are bunkum. Sorry, they're rubbish. The actual reality is that historical structure which I've talked about was firmly established in the 19th century by Western Indologists, and it has been reinforced and confirmed countless times by all the studies that have been done through the 20th century by all scholars. I don't know of any single scholar who seriously questions that general framework. Of course, there's disagreement about details, right? And when scholars in a particular field get together, what do? Do we sit there and enumerate all the things that we agree on? No, of course not. We talk about what we disagree about. Yeah? So if you look at the scholarly discourse, you know, similarly like, in the public sphere, like, say, climate change or something like that, well, of course the scientists are arguing about the details of climate change, but they agree about the fundamentals. So I think it's a step backward, and I think that the academic discourse on Buddhism and to some extent the popular discourse on Buddhism has stepped backwards in the last 10 to 20 years because of an ill-advised neglect of that, of an understanding, a clear understanding of that historical framework. We're only really just beginning to understand how these things work. The basic studies of many of these texts has not been done. The translation, many of these texts I've been talking about have never been translated into a modern language. Yeah? So what's needed, and what I would encourage everybody to do, is to take an interest in them, take an interest in the suttas, take an interest in the Pali Nikayas. Yeah? I was just reading the sutta earlier that was from Access to Insight. It's available easily online. You can get wonderful translations from Bhikkhu Bodhi and others. You can get an access to start reading the suttas, start getting an idea of what's actually contained in them. And that will be a wonderful guide for you to help to ground you and to use your discernment to understand, well, what it is that the Buddha taught and what it is that the Buddha did not teach. Yeah? And as the passage I read at the beginning said, this is something which is important to know and to understand. It doesn't mean, of course, it doesn't mean that things that the Buddha didn't teach are wrong, right? It's not saying that. It's just saying that you have to know what it is that you're talking about. If something's an opinion of a teacher, yeah, if it's my opinion, then you know the difference. Well, that's Sujato's opinion, and you take it for what it is. Yeah, but it doesn't mean it's not the Buddha's words because it comes out of my mouth. So the same thing with talking about these ancient Indian traditions. It doesn't mean that we neglect them or disrespect them or abandon the traditions. The traditions are traditions, and they are invaluable because they are the record of thousands of years of the efforts and the intelligence and the wisdom and the concern of those practitioners and philosophers and students of the Dhamma for thousands of years to try to understand and articulate the Dhamma as they see and knew and understood. So we certainly shouldn't abandon them and disparage them, but we don't understand them, take them for what they are, and not try to pretend that somehow everything that's contained within the tradition must be the literal words of the Buddha. This is going too far. So it's my talk for you this evening. And I hope that was somewhat informative. And any questions or comments? Justin?
The second sutta you read out
said
it's slanderous to not differentiate between what is inferred and what is said.
Yeah.
He said this direct.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate
on the
meaning behind that?
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes you can read a sutta and you can think, well, what he said means this, or he's implying that this is this, but sometimes the meaning is not direct.
Sure.
Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. Of course, there's a lot of variety in the early suttas. Now, I think it's obvious just on a purely general theoretical basis that meaning never resides in a text. Okay? A text is just bits of paper with marks on it, right? So meaning is something that arises in the interaction between a reader and a text. So there's always somehow a subjective element in that reading. But that doesn't mean that it's purely subjective. A text doesn't just mean anything at all, right? The text itself constrains the meaning, but it doesn't make the final determination of what that meaning is. Now, there are different texts will have a different level of ambiguity or interpretability. Is that a word? Different amounts that we can bring our own subjective interpretation to it. Yeah. So look, in modern times, if you have a telephone book, right? Well, there's not a lot of ways to interpret a telephone book. Yeah. There's a name and there's a number. It's pretty straightforward. Yeah. So that doesn't give a lot of wiggle room. Whereas if you read a poem, or say a song lyric, then they obviously very often are intentionally very open. Yeah. They're specifically because they want to create a text that will open up different meanings, yeah? And if you talk to the poet or the songwriter, they will say, that reading is possible, and I wanted it to not determine a final meaning. So there's this kind of quite range. Now, within the suttas themselves, you find this range of kinds of texts. So you find poetry, you find parables, you find similes, you find sort of paradoxes, right? Which are not immediately comprehensible, right? But you also find quite definitive texts, which are almost like a dictionary definition of things. So you find like lists of terms where the Buddha says, say for example, in say the context of dependent origination. Okay, just to take one example, and it says avijja paccaya sankhara, sankhara paccaya vijnana, and then the Buddha says, well, what is avijja? What is ignorance? So ignorance is not knowing of suffering, not knowing the origin of suffering, not knowing the ending of suffering, and not knowing the path to the ending of suffering. What is sankharas? Well, sankharas is meritorious, demeritorious, and imperturbable sankharas, and so on. So there's this series of definitions of terms. So that kind of text is clearly meant to be read in a literal way, right? It's clearly being said, okay, here's a literal definition of it, and so it's much more like a telephone book, right, than it is like a poem. Yeah? So within the suttas, we find that whole spectrum, and in some cases we can say, yes, this is meant to be taken in a straightforward literal way. In other cases, we can say it's clearly not. Yeah? So there's one verse in the Dhammapada. What does it say? It says, having slain one's mother and father and having murdered the Brahmin priest, the stainless one wanders happily free of all sorrow. Something like that. That's a paraphrase. I can't remember the exact details of it, right? Now, that particular sutta, I think we can all agree, was fairly obviously not meant to be taken literally. And if you look in the commentaries, it says, well, when it says slaying mother and father, it means slaying greed and hatred and so on. So it'll give metaphorical interpretation. So there's cases that are clearly meant to be literal and some that are clearly meant to be metaphorical. And then, of course, there are grey areas, right, where it's not so obvious which is which. So in some cases, yes, you can read it in a literal way or in a metaphorical way. There is a lot of cases that are actually found within the suttas of this kind of thing. So, for example, Find sometimes the Buddha comes, he says, I'm just trying to think of an example. I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but he says some kind of very cryptic and paradoxical statement and then just gets up and walks out. Right? So the monks are sitting there going, what was that all about? Yeah? You don't understand that? No, I didn't understand that, you know. So what's going on there? Is the Buddha incapable of explaining something clearly? Well, obviously not. He's doing it because he wanted to prompt that kind of discussion. Right? He wanted them to try to talk and figure things out for themselves. Yeah? So he's clearly meaning some things to be mentioned that way. And there's other cases where the meaning of a sutra is being discussed. And you might have six monks and they all give a different interpretation for that passage. And there may be like a verse and there's six different interpretations. And the Buddha says, actually, each of you spoke well in your own way and each of those six interpretations is valid. But actually, what I meant when I said that verse is this. And so this is the reading that the Buddha said. Yeah. So these interpretive possibilities are found within the suttas themselves. So this is not something that necessarily, when you hear a little passage like that, it sounds quite black and white. But when you look at all of the suttas in detail, you find that it's worked out in quite a nuanced and subtle way across the spectrum of texts as a whole.
Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ abhivāde svākhāto bhagavata dhammo dhammaṁ namassāmi sutatipanno bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho saṅghaṁ